We're in lesson number 40 in the book of 1 Samuel, and I want to ask you to take your Bibles and to open them to chapter number 18. We're down to verse 5, but we're actually still talking about verse 4. And if you remember in our last lesson, when we were together from the verse 4 passage, Jonathan had knit his soul with David, and David has knit his soul to Jonathan. And we were talking about Jonathan was old enough to be David's father, and we've already proven that out, that he's old enough to be David's father. But Jonathan probably looked at David like a son. And I started telling you about people who have, men who have come along in my life and have treated me like a son. And I had mentioned Bobby Haynes, and I'd mentioned Travis Bryce, and I'd mentioned Travis Terrell, and I had mentioned Albert Pittman and Ryan Pittman. Albert is still alive. Ryan has gone to be with the Lord, and how they treated me as sons. I have mentioned Ed Tony and his wife, Sarah Lynn Tony, or Lynn Tony, who had a cup of coffee and an egg sandwich for me every morning as we were going to the Dan Bear Dairy Project to build it for 2 years together. She was providing me with food, and I'd pick up Ed, and then I'd go pick up Albert, and I'd pick up Ryan, and we'd head out for our 45-minute journey out to the build site and then back when we got through later on. And even though they have wonderful sons, they all look to me like at me like a son. Then I mentioned about Sam Davis, and I told you that Sam joined the Lord in heaven this past year, and from the time he retired from sheet metal work, he was with me almost every day, treating me like a son, for he thought of me like a son, and he has a wonderful son by the name of Doug, but he thought of me like a son too. And then I told you, I mentioned the name John Capriva, who is a dear, dear friend of mine even to this day. He is a decade older than I am, who has told me and told many people that I was family with him since 1999 when I met him and our souls were immediately knit together. I talked and mentioned Quincy James, now with the Lord. He was an attorney who hovered over me, and I like to think about this. I mean, he really did hover over my office like a helicopter father from the time I met him in 1993 to make sure that everything was, I was protected, because he knew that my job at that church was right there on the edge, and I needed to make sure I was protected legally and everything. Jack Kitchens, although I only knew him for about 3 years before his death, from back in 93 to 96, I believe, he basically adopted me, and treated me like a son, strapped me in like a son. And those of you who knew Jack Kitchens, he would not let me go. And when he latched on, he did not let go. I then mentioned Earl Havens and his wife, Bertie King Havens. I didn't have time to explain that. 1974, in my very first church, Earl and Bertie latched onto me with everything they had, basically adopting me in Longview, Texas, and making absolutely sure that I had food every day, and even called me their adopted son. Shall I go back even further than that? I think I mentioned his name last week, was Benton Kane, who latched onto me as a 12-year-old boy the year after my father died, and would not let me go until I left for college. He only had a daughter, and her name was Candace. And I was like a son to him. He put me in my first ministry position, leading music at a nursing home every Sunday morning where he delivered the message. His daughter played the piano. And that went on from the time I was 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16. But when I turned 16 and I got my driver's license, well, it was interesting. I got my driver's license, and he just came in the very first week and did not let the ink dry on the driver's license at all. And he pronounced that he was no longer going to be delivering the devotion at the nursing home, and that he has resigned from the nursing home, and he told me that I would be picking up his daughter to continue playing the piano, and I would be leading the music and presenting the message at the nursing home every week, and I did that until I left for college. It was because of that that I had spent several weeks, get this, several weeks at his kitchen table as he mentored me in how to prepare a lesson. With all my education that came after that, my high school diploma, my college diploma, my seminary diploma, my master's diploma, my doctorate diploma, I have never changed how he taught me to prepare a lesson. You are a beneficiary of his love for me like a son that transpired from 1968 until 1974. One more step back in time was to Jules Stroop of the Stroop Honey family. Some of you may buy the Stroop Honey here in the area. At 11, he gave me a job working honeybees. I worked for him for 7 years. He taught me how to work. He taught me how to lift heavy items. He taught me how to drive in a 1956 Chevy pickup with the starter on the floor. He taught me how to do business with the public each holiday season at the fireworks stands they had, and I was running and selling fireworks. He taught me how to load trailers for weight distribution. He taught me how to tie knots to tie things down. He taught me how to pull cars that were stuck in the mud out of the mud. He taught me how to take breaks when needed for a short rest each day to carry on the rest of the day profitably. He truly looked at me like a son. I must confess, there are dozens more men that I have had the long, godly, loving relationship who I should list here. I am greatly blessed by many men who were like father figures in my life, and I was like a son to them. I understand what it means to be knit together. Souls. Knit together. Souls. Knit together. A man with a son. A man with a son. Even though they're not blood kin. No jealousy. No envy. No strife. Only good, even in bad times, for we all have bad times sometimes. Each of these men and many more loved me as they loved their own selves. Each of these men gave me many gifts from that day that I did not deserve. One more name was Bob Elmore. He was a minister of music at my time in my youth. And I walked into him in November and I said, Bob, you know, I surrendered to the Lord's service back when I was 11. And I feel like the Lord is calling me into the music ministry. And if you ever know any place that's going to need a minister of music, would you please share my name? Absolutely, he said. That was in November. The end of November. It was right after Thanksgiving, by the way. The week in between Thanksgiving and the 1st of December. He went to do a revival in Longview, Texas, that I mentioned a while ago, 1974, and the week before January the 20th. And on Saturday night, actually it was on Friday night, on the would be the 19th, he called me and said, Jim, he said, could you come to Longview tomorrow and be here? And we want you to lead the music here in this church where I'm doing the revival this coming Sunday morning and Sunday night. And I said, absolutely. So I hopped in my little car, my little Triumph TR3 sports car, and out there I went in my little sports car. Wrong thing in East Texas to have a sports car and to be a minister, but I did it anyway. Got on out there, led the music in the morning, led the music at night, and to my surprise, on January the 20th, 1974, the pastor, after the invitation was given, stood back the pulpit and said, we think we found our new minister of music. We would like to vote on you tonight, Jim. And he looked it back to me and said, we would like to vote on you tonight. And he just called for the vote, and it was unanimous to make me their minister of music. They didn't know me about nothing. They only knew what my father figure, Bob Elmore, had said to them about me. And he looked back and said, will you take the job? And I said, Pastor Merle, Preacher Merle, I'm going to have to pray about this and talk to my family. I'm not out of school yet. I've still got to finish my senior year in high school. He said, all right. Well, I went back, and 3 days later I called him. I said, I'm going to be there tonight. Is it okay? I'm coming. I'll be there on Wednesdays and Sundays until I graduate, and I'll be there first Sunday full time after I graduate. Come on. And I was the minister of music there. So too, Jonathan gave David that day from his royal wealth what he did not deserve. Bob Elmore gave me what he did not deserve. John Capriva has given me what I did not deserve. Sam Davis, the Pittmans, and I can name other names of men who have given me what I did not deserve. He gave David his royal robe, his armor, his sword, his bow, and his belt. David was part of Jonathan's family now. But from that day, Saul did not let him return to his father's house. Saul's character was not like Jonathan's character. This statement by the writer has much meaning behind it that shows the true character of Saul. He did not let him return to his father's house. Saul latched onto David and would not let him go. He did not do this in a father-son knit-together way, like the relationship with Jonathan and David. He did this in a selfish way. He wanted David nearby so he could keep his eye on David. As we will soon see the reason for this, the people have elevated this young David, 17 years old, there or about, above the king. At least in the eyes of the people, he was above the king. It will make Saul sink into great despair and anger towards David. He was not a son to Saul. He was a possession of Saul's own purpose. And the writer continues to give a summary of what David did in verse number 5. So David, chapter 18, verse number 5. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered. And Saul set him over the men of war. And it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Notice, whatever task Saul sent David to do, David was successful. Notice also that the people were pleased with David. Saul's servants were pleased with David, but the writer does not tell us that Saul was pleased with David. In fact, we're going to find out that he was not. Not to get too far ahead in the storyline, David's successes will irritate Saul to no end. They will not please Saul. The writer sped ahead to tell us about David's future successes in verse number 5, but here in verse number 6, the writer gives a summary of what the women did as David was restricted to be with Saul on the journey back to Gibeah, Saul's capital city and home. Verse number 6. It happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistines, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. The women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. For this to have happened, the story of David's victory over Goliath had to have been spread like wildfire by the warriors of Israel who had already returned to their homes when camp broke back at the Valley of Elah. Now in those days, when battles were over, the men did not match back in formation to some military fort or base or whatever. There were no military base camps in that day. When men were needed, the summons went out, was sent by a courier with the place where they were supposed to meet up and gather. That was included in the notice to everyone. The commanders never knew who would show up to fight until they showed up to fight. And in the same way, when the battles were over, the warriors would simply just disperse from the camp, the military camp where they were at the battlefield, to go home in no required order. This passage also tells us what happened, what the warriors thought about David, even though it does not tell us anything about David. How else will the women in the cities between Socah and Gibeah know about David's victory if the men had not spread the news? the men stood in fear of the giant. David had ended that fear. We must also remember that if the men had returned with a disparaging report about David's victory, the women also would have responded in the same way. The men were happy with David. The women were happy with David. In addition, the men must have had more respect for David than for Saul. And that was reflected in the songs of the women. David had not slain 10,000s at all. He'd only slain one. But he might as well have slain 10,000s in their eyes. He had saved Israel from a renewed Philistine oppression. Well, when Saul heard the songs of the women, the writer tells us a summary of what Saul thought, verse number 8, and it's not good. Then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him, and he said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they've ascribed 1,000. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?" Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. Jealousy. Jealousy. I know about jealousy personally. I know that in my ministry, back in the days of the COVID days, the early days of COVID, when people were required to be home, that my lessons posted on YouTube and Vimeo and Instagram and other places, in a short period of about 6 months, hit more than 290,000 views. And when that word went out to the new pastor of the church, jealousy just went wild. And the day after that word got to the pastor, I accidentally got an email that was not supposed to come to me from another staff member stating that I had too much influence over the church because of all those who were watching. Jealousy. Outright jealousy. Well, from SoCo, right here, in the Valley of Elah, and within that circle I drew there, it was only a long day's journey back to Gibeah, about over in here, about 25 miles. It would have taken Saul no longer than 2 days at the most to get home. Well, it's a long day's journey, but Saul wasn't going to travel that fast. Because Saul's up at 60 years old. What the writer is telling us is that Saul was happy with David on one day and eternally suspicious on David a day or two later. Our title for this section that I'm heading to is A Summary of Saul's Derangement. It's a section in the story of the sickness of King Saul. The writer is about to tell us the reason for the title of the summary of Saul's derangement with the attempt to kill David with a spear. Verse number 10. Now it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. And Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall." But David escaped from his presence twice. Let us set the scene in this passage, folks. A day or two before, David killed Goliath. David has arrived at Saul's home in Gibeah. Saul did not let David return to his home in Bethlehem after killing Goliath. David is playing the harp for Saul, for he has gone crazy, as he was assigned to do before he killed Goliath. And while hearing the music, Saul remembered what the women had said about David the day before, and Saul became angry. And he was angry because the women were esteeming David more than they esteemed him. He was jealous. Saul was smart enough to know that if that was the opinion of the women, it had to be the opinion of the men. And Saul became so angry at David that he tried to kill him with a spear. But David escaped. While the writer is specific about the day after the women praised David, because this is the summary, the writer alludes to an interaction of Saul and David more than once. The writer tells us that David played the harp for Saul as usual. In other words, David played the harp for Saul on a regular basis because Saul was crazy on a regular basis. In addition, the writer tags the spear event by telling us that David escaped from the spear twice. In other words, Saul tried to kill David twice when he was playing the harp with a spear. Again, at some time, that second time, sometime in the future, after this third day since David killed Goliath. Mind you, David is still about 17 years old, give or take a few years, one way or the other, of age, when this happened. He is but a youth. We learn of Saul's second attempt to kill David with a spear in chapter 19, verse 10, but we're not there yet. This was just a summary. Because of Saul's anger with David, and because of his fear of David, because of his jealousy of David, the writer tells us of the order to make David a commander, which, interesting, makes sense in one way and no sense in another way. Verse number 12. Now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them. Because the writer is giving us summaries of things that happened, not all in order, it is difficult to determine how long Saul waited to make David a commander. As a 17-year-old, David was too young to legally be in the army. Yet, he had killed Goliath in battle. And the men could have been willing to follow him as a youth because of that victory. However, the writer has confused the timing in the past. So do you remember when David cut the head of Goliath and he told us that David took the giant's head to Jerusalem before he told us that he showed it to Saul back at the base camp? Well, the writer sped ahead to tell us the eventual instead of staying with the moment. The writer just told us that David fled from the spear of Saul twice when he was only describing the first time. It is therefore possible with this passage that the writer is telling us that Saul made David a commander when he reached the age of 20. Or perhaps it is as it is written, and Saul made David a commander on the day that he threw the spear at him. But then we have to ask, which time did he throw the spear at him? It really does not matter when, but when David became a commander, he far exceeded the expectations of Saul and made matters worse. Saul had often made a promise in the reward, or I should say he made a promise in the reward that he would fulfill with David, the offer of Saul's oldest daughter in marriage. We come to Saul's plan, though, in verse number 17a. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battle." Okay. We have lost a sense of timing with this writer's report, or way the compiler put the different reports together. No doubt Saul has tried to kill David twice by this time. No doubt Saul is fearful of David and made him a commander. No doubt Saul is trying to crawfish on his promise to give his daughter to David as a wife. How do we know that? He sent David into battle before he made the decision to fulfill his promise to give her as a wife. It is found in Saul's words, "I will give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battle." Saul is saying he will give his daughter in the future if David will be a valiant warrior right now. The next verse supports this conclusion. The writer tells us Saul's thought process, verse 17b. For Saul thought, "My hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." Let us translate what Saul is thinking. He is thinking, if David goes out to fight with the Philistines, and they kill him, then he is out of Saul's hair, and Saul will not have to give his daughter to David as a wife. But we come to David's question of the king concerning the king's daughter as a wife. David, in his innocence, took the position of humility with Saul. Verse number 18. But David said to Saul, "Who am I, and what is in my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the king's son-in-law?" Family wealth may be passed down from generation to generation, but family wealth is not always sustained from generation to generation. Boaz was a wealthy man of great honor and prestige when he fell in love with Ruth and took her as his wife. Together they had Obed. Eventually, Boaz died and Obed inherited the fortune. Obed and his wife had a son named Jesse. When Obed died, what did Obed have that he passed on down to Jesse? The eldest son of Jesse told us when David arrived at the battle line with Goliath that the oldest son said, "Why have you left our few sheep to come down here? Why have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" David was not even a shepherd of a large flock, as we often think. As for David's family, they may have been large in number, but humble in means. What in the world had David done? What had his family done to deserve to be the son-in-law of the king, he asked. And even though David knew about the reward, his statement by David seems to indicate that David killed the giant for the national good of Israel instead of the personal good of the reward. David showed his humility in his words.